Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Tim Shorrock, a Washington, D.C.-based journalist who assesses the failure of the recent Trump-Kim summit meeting in Vietnam and prospects for future negotiations with the goal of denuclearizing the Korean Peninsula. Elizabeth Yampierre, co-founder of UpRose, the oldest Latino community organization in New York City, who urges individuals doing climate organizing to respect the work already being done in frontline communities. And Timothy Carr of the media democracy group Free Press, who outlines a new proposal that would impose a tax on targeted social media advertisements in order to revitalize endangered local journalism. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The release of a captured Indian fighter pilot diffused the latest military confrontation between India and Pakistan over Kashmir. The pilot was shot down during the first aerial dogfight over the disputed territory since 1971. The latest round of fighting between the nuclear-armed South Asian neighbours was prompted by a suicide attack on a convoy of India's soldiers by the Islamist group Jaish-e-Mohammed, based in Pakistan. After the suicide attack, India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi, who is running for re-election, promised a jaw-dropping response to the terror attack in Kashmir, a flashpoint for conflict since the 1940s. India attacked what they claimed were terrorist camps on Pakistan's side of the so-called line of control in Kashmir. Pakistan responded by bombing targets in Indian territory. Each side says it has shot down the other nation's planes. Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan said that the Indian pilot's release was a peace gesture, a move that was enthusiastically welcomed by India's people in a large welcome home rally. Global powers, including Russia, China, Britain, and the United States, have urged nuclear-armed Pakistan and India to defuse the crisis. In 2018, over 500 people were killed in violence in Kashmir, the most in a decade. A month before a snap election, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu faces an indictment on charges of bribery, fraud, and breach of trust. The charges relate to a wide-ranging investigation of corruption by Netanyahu over his links to a high-powered Hollywood producer, U.S. billionaire Sheldon Adelson, and Israel's largest telecom giant, Bezeq. Netanyahu returned from a meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin to blast the charges as a witch hunt by Israel's Attorney General, Avichai Mandelblit. In the election, Netanyahu faces off against political newcomer Benny Gantz, former head of the Israeli Armed Forces and candidate of the centrist Blue and White Party Alliance. With the pending indictment, Gantz called on Netanyahu to resign. A decade ago, former Prime Minister Ehud Olmert was forced out of office and later served a year and a half in jail for taking bribes. Netanyahu is accused of accepting $280,000 worth of gifts in exchange for political favors that include his support for the Milchan Law that cut taxes for Israelis returning to their homeland after living abroad, and a quid pro quo arrangement with a major Israeli newspaper that agreed to tone down its critical coverage of the Israeli Prime Minister in return for pressure to limit the circulation of a competing free newspaper owned by American billionaire Sheldon Adelson. Time is running out on 1.4 million Puerto Ricans who have relied on emergency food assistance since Hurricane Maria devastated the island in 2017. Without new appropriations from Congress, over 100,000 people will lose all food aid and tens of thousands will see their assistance cut. Before Hurricane Maria, 45% of Puerto Ricans were living in poverty, three times the poverty rate in the U.S. The American Prospect reports that efforts by Democrats to continue the food aid were blocked by the Trump administration during budget talks to end the federal government shutdown tied to President Trump's demand for funding for his border wall. In the aftermath of Hurricane Maria, Congress boosted funding for food stamps by $1.27 billion. But Puerto Rican officials warned that the amount was insufficient and requested $600 million additional dollars to continue the program through September of this year. According to the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities, without new funding, the maximum food aid benefit for a family of four would be reduced from $649 a month to $410. The Trump administration opposed any additional food aid to Puerto Rico, saying it is excessive and unnecessary. In the end, the spending bill passed by Congress and the White House didn't include any funds for disaster assistance. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Victor Rees.
The second summit meeting between U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in Hanoi, Vietnam, ended without the hoped-for signing of an agreement that would have North Korea begin the process of ending its nuclear weapons program in exchange for the lifting of sanctions. Trump blamed Kim for the failure to reach an agreement on his demand for complete sanctions relief in exchange for dismantling the North's main nuclear complex at Yongbyon. But North Korea's Foreign Minister Ri Yong-ho disputed Trump's explanation, saying that Pyongyang had only demanded partial sanctions relief in return for the closing of Yongbyon. He asserted that the U.S. had wasted an opportunity that may not come again. But according to a South Korean official, the unexpected participation in the talks by Trump's National Security Advisor John Bolton, well known for his pro-war hawkish views and disdain for diplomacy, derailed the negotiations when he demanded the North turn over a full accounting of all of its chemical and biological weapons. Your reporter spoke with Tim Shorrock, a Washington, D.C.-based journalist who spent part of his youth living in South Korea. Here he assesses the outcome of the Trump-Kim summit meeting and prospects for future negotiations with the goal of denuclearizing the Korean Peninsula.
The talk was before this meeting began, it looked like they were, talking about North Korea offering to shut down the Yongbyon facility, which is their largest nuclear, it produces plutonium for their bombs. It also is a uranium enrichment plant. It's a huge complex. They were talking about, shutting that down and in return getting, sort of a partial lifting of sanctions from the U.S. The sanctions that have been imposed on the North. And also, there was talk of both sides opening liaison offices in each other's capital and making a declaration that they support the end of the Korean War. But there got to be a lot of pushback inside the administration from the forces that are, led by John Bolton and Trump's national security advisor, who's never been a friend of negotiating with North Korea. And, there was leaks in the press about how certain officials thought, Trump was going to give away the store and they didn't think that policy was on track and so on. And so, it was very clear that there was some dissension within the administration. Kind of at the last minute, Bolton threw on the table a demand that North Korea also shut down all its, its chemical and biological weapon systems. And this was not even part of the denuclearization talks. And so, he added this, at the Hanoi meeting, and that also, chilled the atmosphere for dialogue. I mean, you have this negotiation supposed to be about nuclear weapons, suddenly you throw in everything else. And that was, in my opinion, that was sort of designed to make the talks fail.
Tim, I wanted to ask you, I guess this is certainly an overarching question. When a lot of American commentators are asked about these talks and the prospects for denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, there's a lot of folks, moderate commentators, folks from right wing and moderate think tanks and so on, who say Kim will never give up nuclear weapons because it's the only insurance policy he has to keep his family dynasty in power. There are certainly people who will point out that Libya is a cautionary tale where the United States worked to denuclearize Libya's in-progress nuclear program. And then, you know, some years later, as we all know, Gaddafi was overthrown and killed. It is a cautionary tale for many nations around the world that if you have the nukes, the United States will not be overthrowing your government anytime soon. What do you make of the analysis that Kim will never give up the nukes because it's the only insurance policy he has?
I don't agree. I think it's very possible he would. But like I said, I think there has to be a situation where he feels his country is secure, you know, without them. And actually, you know, no chance of a U.S., you know, regime change operation or invasion or attack. And so, you know, the first two steps of the agreement that they made in Singapore was, one, to establish new North Korea-U.S. relations, and two, you know, work toward a, you know, peace regime in between North and South Korea. And so, like, to them, like, you know, restoring, it's never had one really before, creating a new relationship with the U.S. where they're no longer enemies is their priority. And that's why they have the weapons. And if they feel like that, if they can have a relationship and, you know, develop economic ties, cultural ties, then that's when, you know, denuclearization would be at the last stage of that. And that's sort of how the South Koreans see it, too. Not denuclearization as an end in and of itself, but as the end of a process in which the U.S. and South Korea stop being enemy states and be at least, you know, on a normal relationship like you have with other countries, not necessarily friends or allies, but, you know, no longer enemies. I disagree with people who say that. And there's also a lot of propaganda here among the think tanks and these sort of, you know, huge new generation of, you know, North Korea so-called experts, you know, who say North Korea's real aim is to drive U.S. forces out of South Korea and unify the country under their own system, which is, you know, I think it's bunk.
That was Tim Sharrock, a Washington, D.C.-based journalist and author of the book Spies for Hire, The Secret World of Intelligence Outsourcing. Find links to Sharrock's recent articles on the Korean summit and related analysis by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The 9th Annual Conference on New Directions in Environmental Law took place at Yale University's School of Forestry and Environmental Studies on March 2nd. Organizers of the gathering maintain that climate change is the greatest threat to social justice, human rights, and progress around the world. Conference participants explored existing challenges and legal and policy solutions to the crisis, placing climate justice at the center of the discussion. Those speaking at the conference addressed topics including the impact of the climate crisis on immigration, incarcerated individuals, low-income communities, and communities of color. Also explored were responses to climate change that will generate justice and equity. One of the conference keynote speakers was Elizabeth Yompierre, co-founder of UPROSE, the oldest Latino community organization in New York City, who also serves as co-chair of the National Climate Justice Alliance. Yompierre, who's of African and indigenous descent, focused her remarks on the need for those doing climate organizing to respect the work already being done in frontline communities. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus attended the conference and brings us this excerpt of her talk.
When I was sitting, listening to the compañera speak, I was reminded that the climate justice movement is led by women. We are a leaderful, intergenerational, grassroots movement, and the leaders throughout the country and in our communities are mostly women of color. I also was really heartened to see the word justice, because there are a lot of folks who think they understand what justice is, and are not. They are climate missionaries. They are climate colonizers. They are people who believe in climate change but don't know how to support the grassroots and really come in with the solutions and helicopter in to tell us what's in our best interest. So I guess my question for folks who say that they really care about climate change is, why are these organizations that are new and are developing right now, if they care about climate change, not mapping this country and assessing where the gaps are, where there's a need to build climate consciousness, where there's a need to basically get folks that are on the margins or even in the red states to start understanding the connection between climate change and their survivability? Instead, what all of these organizations are doing, and I'm not going to put them on blast and name them, is looking at places where there is already frontline leadership. Already frontline leadership, whether it's in Seattle, whether it's in the Gulf South, whether it's in Kentucky, whether it's in Brooklyn or the Bronx, whether it's in Detroit. All of them are meeting and making a beeline for our communities, getting a lot of resources to descend into our communities, supplant local leadership, duplicate work, create redundancy and a waste of resources, and colonize our communities by telling us that people of privilege seem to care more about climate change than we do, know more about climate change than we do, and really making it impossible for the front line to speak for itself. It is going to make us fail. We will lose if people continue to descend on the same communities, because descending on our communities and places that are already doing the work is lazy, it's easy, it's so much harder to roll up your sleeve and go into places where there is no climate consciousness. And so I'm saying that to you because just this week, a meeting being had in DC to talk about how to get people of color and low-income people to have a platform on the Green New Deal. Well, we have a platform on the Green New Deal. We responded to the Green New Deal. How many of you are supporters of the Green New Deal? All right, so when we looked at the Green New Deal, we had questions. We wanted to know why there was language in there about cap and trade. We wanted to know why there was language in there about sequestration and carbon capture, and why it wasn't centered on frontline communities, and why it wasn't building on the work on just transitions, which our communities are doing. And a just transition is really an economic frame that moves us away from fossil fuel extraction to a regenerative economy, the kind of work that you see happening in our communities all over the country. And so we had a critique. And people responded to us in a negative way because we were critiquing the Green New Deal. Well, Alexandria comes from the Bronx, you know, and we felt like we had a right to say, activists don't sign a blank check. We want to make sure that frontline communities are centered, that we are creating holistic responses, that the resources are being invested locally in communities, that communities are not being displaced as a result of environmental amenities as they have when we want environmental successes. I know that in my community, when we doubled the amount of open space, stopped the siting of a power plant, had an aggressive urban forestry campaign, that developers started using our successes as a way of displacing us. So that can't happen. Because when you basically supplant and push people out, you destroy social cohesion. And so it is really important for us to start really committing to building just relationships, engaging in self-transformation, and working with each other in a way that we have never worked with each other before. It means checking privilege. It means really challenging the way that you come to the work. Because the truth is that we will not survive unless we deal with questions of race and the fact that really this is about the intersection of racial injustice and climate change, right? And so that is the harder thing to do. It is much easier to talk about bioswales and installing green roofs and thinking about infrastructure and how do we make sure that we have permeable surfaces. That is so much easier to talk about than to talk about issues of race. And we can't talk about climate change without talking about race. And we can't build relationships unless people are introspective and understand how they come to this work and how they use or abuse their privilege in this.
That was Elizabeth Yompierre of UPROSE and the Climate Justice Alliance. Find more discussion on the issues of climate change organizing by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Over the last decade and a half, the U.S. media landscape has changed dramatically, with, according to a 2018 study, 20% of the nation's newspapers have closed down since 2004, leaving 900 communities without local news resources. Another recent survey, conducted by the Pew Research Center, found that between 2003 and 2014, the number of full-time newspaper reporters covering statehouses in the U.S. fell by 35%. These disturbing numbers, cited in a recent proposal from the media democracy group Free Press, provides the rationale for a new initiative to address the decline in U.S. journalism. In a paper co-written by Free Press staffers Timothy Carr and Craig Aaron titled Beyond Fixing Facebook, the group proposes the imposition of a new tax on targeted ads to fund civic-minded journalism. Your reporter spoke with Tim Carr, Free Press Senior Director of Strategy and Communications, who describes the decline in U.S. journalism, its impact on a functioning democracy, and how the proposed tax on major social media companies' targeted ads could strengthen locally owned, independent media outlets.
News organizations have been bleeding reporters for the last couple of decades, and a lot of the initial decline was really due to their own mismanagement and this trend that we've seen over the years towards media consolidation, where you have one company owning several television stations like Sinclair, or you have one company owning several newspapers like Tribune Media at one point. And what happens when this industry consolidates in this way? They like to use these terms of like synergies and things like that that would result from these mergers. But what synergies really means in the real world has been journalism layoffs. But in the last 10 years, we've seen also this transformation of the media economy. Commercial journalism was powered by advertising, whether it be print advertising or radio and television advertising. That was the money that supported reporters and kept many of them on the beat for quite some time. And in the last 10 years, that whole model has changed to online advertising. Online advertising is really controlled these days by just two companies. Facebook and Google control 70% of online advertising in the United States. But these two companies are not news organizations. They don't support journalists. They don't hire, they don't have newsrooms. They don't hire journalists. They don't have news producers. So you've seen this siphoning of money away from a media and economy that used to support journalism towards one where journalism is not, that has been factored out. And to add to that problem, we've also seen, and we've learned a lot in the last year, social networks like Facebook and Twitter and even Google expedite the spread of misinformation. We learned about Cambridge Analytica last year, which is a data firm that used Facebook data to misinform voters about the U.S. election, about the Brexit elections in the U.K. So not only are we losing journalists, we're also seeing the increased speed of the spread of information around the world. So it's become this sort of perfect storm, and that's why we have put forth this paper that I hope to talk about a little more.
Tim, lay out for our audience the proposal to impose a tax on targeted advertisements to fund what you term a civic-minded journalism.
Well, because there is this great imbalance in the media economy these days, and because we've seen the spread of misinformation do harmful things in democratic society, it's also fomented hatred and violence in other parts of the world. We have proposed a tax on the economy behind online platforms that really drives a lot of the Silicon Valley companies, and a tax of, for example, 2% in the United States would generate nearly $2 billion. And we've proposed creating what's called a public interest media endowment, where that money would go, and it would be similar in some ways to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting in that it's a quasi-governmental organization that then distributes that money to the sort of local, investigative, civic-minded journalism that we hope to see more of, a lot of the local journalism that we've lost over the last 2 decades.
Now, explain to our audience a bit about the public interest media endowment that you envision and how that entity would allocate funds.
Well, I mean, we've been thinking about this for a number of years now, and we've actually had some success on a very local level. Over the last couple years, we've been working in the state of New Jersey to create what's called the Civic Information Consortium. And as a result of money that New Jersey made from the sell-off of public media television station licenses, we've created this fund for the state of New Jersey, and it starts with just $5 million. We're hoping to raise more money for it from the state coffers that goes towards supporting local journalism. And as we've worked on that, we thought, well, we could scale this to a national model. A carbon tax is used by many countries to tax energy companies that are emitting dangerous emissions into the air. And that money is then used to clean up the mess they've made. Well, this is like a carbon tax in that we're taxing these social media companies to help clean up the mess they've made. And the best way to do that is to fund the antidote. The antidote to misinformation is good local journalism, good investigative journalism, civic engagement projects. So that's basically how we created this structure.
That was Tim Carr, Free Press Senior Director of Strategy and Communications, and co-author, along with Craig Aaron, of the group's new report titled Beyond Fixing Facebook. Find a link to the report and related articles by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on RECFM in Riverton, Maryland, KKFI in Kansas City, Missouri, KUGS in Bellingham, Washington, and dozens of other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Nigel Victor Reese, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.